Yahweh was explicit in his condemnation of America, calling out the nation by name to explain why he was so disgusted by it. And in that there was no name for America 2,700 years ago when this prophecy was first provided, and that there was no way to describe the new world other than to say it's on the far side of the world, the opposite side of the world from Israel, God did a very effective job of not only designating its location, but also describing its nature and people. Now, after designating that it would be a country known for its naval prowess, for its desire to interfere in other people's affairs, projecting a force, and his statement about the fact that Apache gunships, that whirling and buzzing wings would be a symbol of this nation, God said, the nation of people from different races and places is tall, intoxicated, and immodest, and they have a propensity to take things away from others. They are scrubbed clean, smooth-skinned, and completely shaven, and yet typically reckless. These people are feared, sometimes even revered, but are astonishingly intimidating from here to there in a future time. This population, which is comprised of so many different races, routinely vomits up and spews out nonsense in a strange foreign language, talking down to others, mocking them, while continually marching off to war on this condescending and moronic rhetoric, always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules, while eagerly expecting to throw others out of their land. It aggressively subdues, trampling people down, kicking them out. This is a country which is divided by rivers. Now, before we continue our review of this, and we were detailed last week in talking about the naval prowess of the nation, the fact that it is comprised of many people from many different races, I do want to emphasize what we can learn by the term Goyim being applied to America. But before we do, we have Bob, who's calling in from Florida. I'd like to welcome Bob to the program, except for some reason my switchboard isn't working. But do I hear you, Bob?
Hey, Yana. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can. Right. Go ahead.
How are you today?
Wonderful.
Good. It's off your topic, so I hope that's okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
A real stick in my spokes here. I just kind of want to get your take on it.
Okay.
We know that Shaul is an enemy of Yah, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Shaul is known to Christians as Paul. His given name was Shaul. It means to question him.
Okay. When you try to share the truth about Paul with someone,
mm-hmm.
and they flat out say, pretty much, quote unquote, I don't want to hear anything about Paul. I love Paul.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, is that person considered an enemy of Yah?
Oh, yeah, that's really an interesting situation. At what point does a victim become a victimizer? You know, Paul was clearly a victimizer. He was an avowed enemy of Yahweh and Yahweh's Torah and was extraordinarily adversarial. So Paul is clearly a victimizer. Now, someone who falls in love with Paul, which, you know, most Christians do. If you go to a Christian Bible study, they're almost invariably studying one of Paul's letters. And if you go to listen to a Christian sermon, probably 80% of them are based on Paul's letters. So Christians are enamored with Paul. Now, is the person who is enamored by a beguiler a beguiler, or are they simply the victim? And my thinking, the best way I know how to answer the question, Bob, is to say that when it's a very fine line that you have to be careful crossing, and I warn people of this all the time. It's one thing to be fooled by the likes of Paul. I was fooled by Paul for a long time. He is a fairly clever deceiver. And so It's one thing to be fooled by him and to be a victim of him. If you're fooled by him and a victim of him, then end of your life, your soul will simply cease to exist. There is no penalty. There's no torment in hell. You squandered your life by choosing to trust someone who was untrustworthy. But when that person then advocates on behalf of Paul, when the person does something like what Rick did here in the program yesterday and calls in to advance Paul as a credible spokesperson for God, then you've crossed the line. Now you are no longer just a victim. You're promoting a lie, and you're trying to sell the lie, and at that point you become a victimizer. Now, you gave a very specific example. You said if somebody says, I don't want to hear anything about Paul, I love Paul, at that point they're not a victimizer. And particularly with you, since you know the truth, their affinity for Paul isn't going to cause you to reject the Torah or reject Yahweh or reject the covenant. So they haven't done anything that is harmful in just saying that to anyone other than themselves. Right. And that's really the difference between a victim and a victimizer is who have they harmed? And in this case, they only harmed themselves. They didn't harm anyone else.
Well, here's where it gets tricky.
Okay.
When someone claims that and they observe Yah's feast,
mm-hmm.
I'm kind of uncomfortable sitting down with them.
Yeah, I would too.
I sit down at Yah's feast. I'm totally flawed. I got more flaws mm-hmm. than most.
Right. Yeah. So do I. In fact, we could have a contest. it's one of the things about this program. We don't present. The host does not present himself as flawless and as an example. We only present Yahweh as flawless and as the example, and we strive to share what he has shared. God's whole Torah, his teaching, his plan is designed for flawed folks like you and me, Bob, because, quite frankly, that's the only kind of folks there are.
Right, exactly. So my reasoning is sound as far as feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. I would. Yep. There are a lot of people that I know. I used to co-author books with a fellow that really a likable guy, really nice man. And we did a lot of studies together and came to learn a lot of things together. But he continued to lead a prayer music group in on a local church and continued to cling to Christianity and therefore clung to Paul. And was unwilling to let go of his Christianity. And so is not a person that I felt comfortable continuing to celebrate the feast with. And so I've just refrained. It doesn't mean that I don't like the individual. I do. I really like him.
Right.
I'm a really, really nice human being. Uh-huh. Misguided on something that's extraordinarily important.
Yeah.
But I'm just, that's not the kind of person I want to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bekonim with. I want to celebrate it with those who are wholeheartedly, mentally, devoted to, engaged with, Yahweh and his testimony and who have said goodbye to religion. So I would take the same approach that you've taken as if they're still clinging to Pauline Christianity, then you don't want to celebrate Pesach with them. You're not going to be celebrating eternity with them. So it's probably a good thing. If you still like the individual,
yes.
Just don't make them part of your celebration because God's not going to have them be part of his celebration.
Right.
So I think the smart thing to do is to follow God's lead on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know that's the that is the fine line, and it's why I know at my pay grade I'm not authorized to determine when somebody has crossed that line. I can warn them that the line is there. I can warn them to be really careful, and don't make this transition from being a victim of the lie to a promoter of the lie. You can warn people, but you know the nice thing about our job as God's children is at this point we don't have the responsibility for determining who has crossed that line because there's a real difference in outcome. Bob, as I'm sure you know, the victim simply ceases to exist. No pain, no punishment, no eternal torment. The victimizer is held accountable for what they've done and leading others away from Yah. And so they go to the place of eternal separation, which is named the same exact same Hebrew word as Shaul's name. It's Sheol. And that's where they'll spend eternity. So it is a very dangerous line with horrific consequences.
Absolutely.
For crossing, and you want to be really careful. So I think with that friend, I would just say, listen, I'm not comfortable with celebrating Yah's feast with you as an advocate of Paul. And, you know, the only advice I'm going to leave you with, and, you know, it's your choice.
Sure.
You know, God's all into free will, is please refrain from promoting your view of Paul to others, because that could put you in a very, very bad situation. And
beautiful.
As your friend, I don't want you to go there.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
All right.
Now, as we continue to survey Yah's testimony, we look at the word goyim. It was used multiple times, and it will be used multiple times more throughout this presentation. That Yahweh is saying that this singular nation, because he uses goy as in singular to speak about, well, this is one nation in a future time that is distinguished by these things, including being the opposite side of the world of Israel, that it is filled with goyim. So one nation that is expressly known for racial diversity. That'd be America, the melting pot. And well, many nations have a history, because the next thing we read there was drug abuse, that they are intoxicated. There are a lot of countries that have problems with alcohol and drug abuse. But America is the nation that is best known for its war on drugs. It has made that concept of a war on drugs synonymous with the United States. It's funny, of course, that the war on drugs has, during its lifetime, has resulted in more people using drugs, more people dying as a result of drugs, more people being incarcerated as the result of drugs, and drugs being more accessible and of a higher quality, greater purity, greater strength is the direct result of America's war on drugs. Kind of like America's war on terrorism. It's made terrorism more prevalent, not less prevalent. War on drugs is a complete failure. But we'll consider the implications of this term when we return. Indicated that this nation that he is assailing would be known as being intoxicated. It's relevant to know that Americans are the leading consumers of mind-altering narcotics, prescribed, recreational, and deadly. The U.S. prison population is the largest in the world in aggregate and per capita, with the preponderance of the inmates being incarcerated for drug-related crimes. Americans are the leading consumers of cocaine. And according to the World Health Organization, overall drug use in the United States is the highest in the world. Recently, the U.S. DEA announced that prescription drug abuse had become the nation's largest and fastest-growing problem. It is interesting to note that while Americans are the most intoxicated people on earth, due to the prevalence and quality of treatment facilities, the nation ranks 29th worst out of 192 nations in overall deaths from illicit drug use. Should you be interested, the leaders in this awful fate include a number of Islamic nations where life isn't worth living, among several of the most devoutly Christian nations on earth. More people per capita die of drug use in Afghanistan than any place else. Yemen is second on the list. Guatemala, which is resolutely Roman Catholic, is third. Laos, fourth. Cambodia, Morocco, Libya, Georgia. Yeah, Georgian Republic is interesting. I spent a fair amount of time studying the Georgian Republic because of some of the Inde's prophecies, trying to get a feeling for what they were like. It is the most resolutely Orthodox Christian culture in the world. The Orthodox Georgian Christian Church has a 90+% approval rating amongst the people and is the dominant influence in the society. And yet, look how many of them kill themselves with drug abuse. The next on the list in order of propensity to kill themselves with drugs, after the Georgian Republic are Somalia, Iraq, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Tunisia, Lebanon, Tajikistan, Egypt, Serbia, Myanmar, Iran, the Sudan, Syria, the Ukraine, and Bangladesh. All of but one of those countries, a majority Muslim. Since it was mentioned relative to height, and Yahweh says this is a tall nation. Nations which border the North and Baltic Seas are home to the tallest people on Earth on average. But after the frosty Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Lithuania, Estonia, Finland, and Germany, with these hearty Baltic peoples averaging 6 feet, the United States boasts the world's tallest temperate zone population at nearly 5'11". Over half an inch taller than the average Israeli. Actually, over an inch taller than the average Israeli. Well, I could not find a ranking for her personal hygiene because it talks about them being fixated on grooming and bathing. I found ample evidence that suggests that Americans not only spend more money per capita on cleaning and cosmetic products, there is a growing emphasis on being clean-shaven, which was one of the items on the list, to the point of spending time and money to remove body hair from most everywhere. A growing number of men have shaved chests and shaved heads. So considering the propensity of Israelis and their principal foes, Arab Muslims, to be relatively short in stature, overly hairy, typically bearded, and often inadequately bathed, Yahusha's comparative depiction and his terminology seems fitting for this new and very different foe. Now, having traveled throughout the world in nearly 150 countries, I've gained a perspective on how others view the United States. The first word which comes to mind is arrogant. The second is obnoxious. The third is clueless. Recently, Russian President Vladimir Putin took U.S. President Barack Obama to task in an open letter published in the New York Times for promoting the egotistical notion of American exceptionalism, an idea that Americans are somehow superior to all other nations. Yes, there was once a time when the United States was the world's bank, the most prosperous nation on earth. But having overextended itself, it is bankrupt, having squandered its children's future with a national debt soaring toward $20 trillion. And while Americans are told that the nation is a force for good, the country's spy network, its military, and diplomats have broken most everything they have touched internationally. We fit this prophecy perfectly. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Americans have the propensity to think of themselves as the most generous nation on earth, but historically that just isn't the case. The first colonists took America from the native peoples, often brutalizing them in the process. When Indian resistance to manifest destiny was finally broken, America stole Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California from Mexico by waging war against the Mexicans. The Philippines were obtained the same way, this time in the war against the Spanish. And now the United States wants to take God's land away from his people. America's military is the most massive in human history. It's larger than every other military on earth combined. The nation has wasted $30 trillion on its war machine over the past 50 years, leaving Americans less free and more vulnerable in the process. After marching off and fighting 101 wars, one every 4 years, since Europeans first arrived in the New World, the warmongering nation wants to take on God. forcing his chosen people out of their homes. God is not amused, which is why America is being warned at this point. I've mentioned this multiple times for a number of reasons. First, John Kerry is in and out of Israel as we share this testimony. He's told the Israelis, as has Obama, that if they don't capitulate and accept the latest U.S. Land for Peace plan, which gives the West Bank to the Muslims, that Israel will be delegitimized internationally and subject to debilitating sanctions. And second, historically and prophetically, Yahweh only comments on nations that interact with Israel, especially those which aid and abet the nation's demise. It all goes back to the promise Yahweh made to Abraham, whereby those who support Yisrael and the covenant would be blessed, while those in opposition would be cursed. From God's perspective, the United States of America has become his people's most destructive adversary. And from this viewpoint, do not lose sight of the fact that in addition to the U.S. instigating the wars, which are currently engulfing the Islamic world, especially the proxy war in Syria, America is the nation most responsible for thinning Israel at the waist. Further, the vast preponderance of the weapons that will be wielded at Israelites by the flood of Muslim terrorists to come and by the Islamic armies after the Syrian war is over will have been furnished by the United States. It is this unpopular truth that tells us that most everything the United States has done over the past 50 years, militarily, politically, and economically, has been ill-conceived and counterproductive, all leading up to the two biggest blunders in the nation's history, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. military once again trampled people underfoot in an ill-fated attempt, to impose the nation's will. To make them just like us, Democrats. And while these suicidal misappropriations of force made the United States more vulnerable, the realization that it will lead to America sacrificing Israel to Muslims, throwing the rightful inhabitants out of their land, is what is engendering Yahweh's anger. And it will turn out to be an irrecoverable mistake, instigating World War III. A miscalculation for peace that ends in war. This politically, economically, and militarily inspired capitulation to evil will be fatal for Americans. Instrumental to this mistaken judgment is the nation's nonsensical rhetoric. The public discourse has become a stream of amoral misconceptions. Unfounded opinions and outright lies. The media is more prone to error than truth. And if it weren't for lies, politicians would be moot. Teachers indoctrinate and generals use propaganda. Clerics have become the worst of a bad lot, trading false hope for donations. The final depiction, that of a land divided by rivers, also fits the United States. If it were river singular, the U.S. would have competition from Africa and South America with the Nile and Amazon. But that's not the case when the term is plural. Nothing distinguishes America more geographically from other continents more than its many voluminous and long rivers which divide the land. They include the Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio, Arkansas, Colorado, Columbia, Rio Grande, Tennessee, Brazos, Yellowstone, St. Lawrence, Hudson, James, Shenandoah, Potomac, Rappahannock, Susquehanna, the Sac, the Kern, and the Yukon, to name a few. In summary, we know that the United States is a melting pot of peoples and thus quintessentially Gentile. More than any other nation, any other country, it likes to meddle in other people's affairs. Americans think it's their obligation to the world and to their God to set the rules, which is why its military is used to impose democracy on others. Americans talk a lot, all too often projecting an altered state of reality, which is why political and religious talk radio is so influential in this culture. And patriotically, the U.S. marches off to wars, 101 of them, typically leaving the places the military has tread underfoot worse than they were before. Then there's the realization in his prophetic letter to the last assembly in Revelation, where Yahusha specifically called the democratic Laodicean Christians vomit. Only one nation meets all of these criteria: America in the early days of the 21st century. Now, we'd be remiss if we didn't consider the reason Yahweh transitioned from warning the tidal wave of militant Muslims who will seek to terrorize, plunder, and destroy Israel, that they will be destroyed, to God admonishing the United States. How does rebuking and removing Islamic jihadists from the promised land lead to a highly unflattering rebuke of America? What will the nation do to engender God's explicit condemnation? Some of the answers are posted prominently on the front pages of our newspapers. America's foolish and counterproductive invasion of Iraq led to the proxy war being fought in Syria. That's how all of this began. It's the catalyst. It not only empowered Iran, it armed both sides in a conflict which has become so deadly. Israel will be sacrificed by America in hopes of appeasing the Islamic terrorists it has assisted. Then, following this miscalculation, it's already obvious that American weapons will be brought to bear against the promised land. And all the while, we can expect to hear patriotic Americans bellowing, "God bless America." But as ugly a picture as this paints, I think there'll be more to it than all of this. Based upon the next announcement, God isn't just adverse to the United States, it's appear that he's going to oppose the United States. After warning America and besmirching the nation, Yahweh is declaring that he's going to intervene and take a stand on behalf of those who dwell in the promised land. But since this follows God's denunciation of America, if the United States, who his banner is raised against and who is his shofar is being blasted to warn against the world, for the whole world to know, then what else could he be talking about? He says, "All of those who inhabit the earth and those who dwell in the land, when the sign on the upright pole is lifted up on the mountain, you will all see. And when the shofar, the ram's horn, sounds, you will all hear." Yeshayah 18:3. In this particular case, God has distinguished the whole earth, which is Tebel, the world, and the promised land, which is the Eretz, from one another. He says, everybody in the promised land is going to know, but everyone in the world is going to know. When Yahweh lifts up his pole, he raises the banner, he signals from Nakak, to lift up and display an ensign and sign on the mountain. Everyone's going to see. Everyone's going to hear his shofar, the trumpet comprised of a ram's horn for signaling. Going to hear when it sounded, when it's blown. Everyone's going to hear. So is God now battling man for the world he created? If so, it won't be much of a fight. Yahweh is not going to leave any doubt in anyone's mind who's going to ultimately prevail. Everyone the world over, and especially those in the land of Israel, will see his banner raised upon the upright pole, one set atop the summit of Mount Moriah. And every individual will hear the sound of his shofar blaring out an undeniable message, a pertinent warning. Those in opposition will be powerless before him. And those who know him, those who love him and rely upon him, will be protected by him. This is all breathtaking in its implications. The symbolism laden in these terms is relevant. Yahweh's set apart and diminished corporeal manifestation, Yahusha, is the upright one, the perfect Lamb of God who was affixed to the upright pole on Mount Moriah on Passover. His willingness to stand up for us in this way on this day now becomes clearer to a world which has for too long sought to deny these implications. Yahweh is fascinating, and in this presentation of his fulfillment, facilitating what he has been pleading with us to consider from the first day his Torah was given to us as a gift to guide us home. The message is Shamar. Closely examine and carefully consider his guidance. And in the light, the shofar will audibly display the power of the Zeruah, the sacrificial lamb. Pay attention. Observe one, listen to the other. Act upon what you learn. There's a great deal at stake. We'll be back in a moment. For those who become observant, for those willing to listen to Yahweh's voice, for those who come to know and understand who Yahweh is and what he's offering, the anticipation of his imminent return will get those who have been left behind during the harvest and have had to endure the horrid days of the tribulation, will get them through. And so, while God has intervened a second time, now the first time was to blow, well, actually, this is really a third time, because the first was right after Israel is thinned and before the tribulation becomes lethal, Yahweh harvests his children. He removes his children. Then, when Israel cannot defend itself, and where America's malfeasance at thinning the country makes it too vulnerable to withstand the flood of Islamic terrorists, God intervenes and blows them away, hopefully drying out the land and the process of the corruption. And then God intervenes when America gets unruly and establishes himself upright, making no doubt whatsoever that he himself has intervened to stop the onslaught. And so it's at this time we listen to these words. Indeed, because here and now, at this point in time, Yahweh says, as for me, I will be silent and at peace, removed from the tribulation in a better place. Then I will look, choosing to always be observant in my dwelling place, in the manner radiant and glowing, warm and passionate, like light, akin to an enveloping cloud of encompassing dew in the warmth and enthusiasm of the harvest. You see, I think this moment of God's lifting up the sign that the whole world can see, and I think it's going to actually be his ten statements, the etched in stone. I think he's going to lift those and allow the whole world to read them and to consider the implications. And when he blows his trumpet saying, you know, I'm the one who took this stand. This is the third time I've intervened already. At that point, I think it brings us to the middle of the tribulation. There are too many references, particularly in Daniel, to a 3.5-year period where the Torahless one, the beast, has dominion over the earth. And he's going to claim, his testimony is going to be almost identical to Paul's when you read it, what is revealed through Daniel. And he's going to come up with a very beguiling corruption piled right on top of the truth. And as a Orthodox Christian, maybe even as a Roman Catholic, but certainly as a Pauline Christian, he's going to change the times, going to change the dates that we celebrate our meetings with God. And he's going to claim God's authority to do these things. And God's going to give him 3.5 years. God's going to pull away. And for 3.5 years, the Torahless one is going to have his way with Israel, with those who have come to embrace the covenant, but after the harvest. And he's going to have worldwide dominion, according to the testimony we find in Daniel. Because God's going to do exactly what you would expect a father to do. He's kept the Muslims. First, he brought his children home. He kept the Muslims from destroying the Promised Land, blew them away. He kept the United States from annihilating the world in world war. He's revealed himself. He's made it perfectly clear that he exists and that this is his plan. He has his messengers holding up the 10 statements that he etched in stone. And at that point, God's not going to intervene. He's going to say, all right, mankind, you've got your choice. I'm going to give the adversary and his beast reign of the earth. Exactly 3.5 years is what you've got. A time times and half a time, as it is presented in Daniel. 3.5 years. This is your time. Do whatever you want. As for me, he says, yeah, I'm going to spend my time in a better place, in heaven. Doing a better thing. Warm and radiant, glowing, encompassing his children like the dew upon the harvest. God is going to play dad. It's the role that he covets most. It's what he created the universe to do. He's going to enjoy his relationship with his children. He is going to be in a better place. He's going to let the world degrade. He isn't going to perpetrate the harm that the world is enduring. He instead is going to spend this time loving his children. We'll be back with you at this time tomorrow. May God bless.